Right, let's practice saying our names in the order that we're going to say our names.
What order are we going to say our names in?
I don't know. Let's improvise. On my screen, it goes Ben, Graham, Mike, and me.
Oh, no, I have me, Mike, Graham, you.
Oh no, this is where we all get confused, isn't it?
What about the alphabetical order of the distros that we use?
Yeah, let's choose that. I use.
What's... How do we know?
And which distro? The one I'm recording on, the one I'm videoing on, or the one I use mostly?
Maybe this wasn't such a good idea.
All right, I'm going to go first. Ben's going to go after me. Graham's going to go after Ben. Mike's going to go last.
Okay.
Great.
that's alphabetical order, isn't it?
Yeah, it
is. That's what we always do.
Fantastic. Hello, listeners, and welcome to the Linux Voice Podcast Series 3, Episode 7. I'm Andrew Gregory.
I'm Ben Everard.
I'm Graham Morrison.
Oh, sorry, I was watching the snooker. I'm Mike Saunders.
And in this snooker-packed podcast, we've got news, we've got a halfway reminder, we've got discoveries, we've got neurons, we've got a voice of the masses. Have we got any neurons, Mike?
We do. We have one this episode.
Fantastic stuff. So all the jibber jabber about free software that we can think of this fortnight. If you like the sound of this and prefer to hear it in paper format or maybe even EPUB format or PDF format, there's a magazine that we do which is also called Linux Voice, and you can find it on shop.linuxvoice.com and Tesco's and Asda and Barnes and Noble and WH Smith's and other shops.
And issue 15 goes on sale today in the UK, in all those places.
In all those places, yes.
It's pretty awesome. How do we recognise it? What's on the cover? How to hack, isn't it?
Oh, yes.
Hack the web.
Great big word, hack, in great big letters. And that's a feature on penetration testing written by Ben Everard, who also has the news.
Yes, I do have the news. Is it time for the news?
Yeah, why not?
Right, news it is. First up in the news this fortnight, after 2 years of development, Debian have released Jesse, the latest incarnation in the Debian line of Linux distributions. It comes with systemd. Improved UEFI support.
Ooh.
Possibly the most controversial Debian distro to date.
And
the main reason for it is it brings in the latest version of all the packages and whatnot.
There's something else about it that hasn't been mentioned much yet, and that's that it's got 5 years of support. This is the first Debian LTS release. Previously, the releases were supported for 1 year after the next one was released. And in the last few years, each Debian has been released in about 2 years. So this is the first time it's going to be significantly longer, 5 years, which brings it up. It's getting towards like Ubuntu LTS then and CentOS and Red Hat Enterprise Linux.
What does that mean with a community distro, though? I mean, with, say, Ubuntu, it means that there's a company behind it that will support it, Canonical. But with Debian, who's supporting it?
Well, I mean, the security team, the developers, they've committed to doing this. Yeah, obviously, there's no guarantee a Debian project could collapse overnight if there's infighting about another init system or something. But, you know, they're saying this is our intention. And it's really, really good because Debian is incredibly stable. It's very well engineered. But it has sort of been missing this ultra long-term support that some of the other big name distros have. And now it's on a par with them.
Yeah, I hadn't actually heard that, but that does sound like good news. It's one more year for the previous release of Jesse support.
Exactly, yeah. What was the previous release called? Weezer? I can't remember. But
So that would be 3 years in total.
Yes.
2 years as a main, then 1 year. So this is...
Exactly.
An extra 2 years on that.
Yeah, users of Debian 7 have 1 year now to update. So there's still plenty of overlap. You know, they will want to wait for Debian 8.1 or 8.2, a lot of conservative businesses and the like.
Yeah.
But yeah, systemd is obviously an enormous change. This is, The last of the big distros, perhaps outside of Slackware, if you call it big, to make the switch. A lot of people said it's gone pretty smoothly, given that it's such an invasive change.
Well, a huge proportion of users shouldn't really notice anything.
Yeah.
I mean, you can use any distro perfectly happy and never notice what init system you're using. It's only if you're getting into the nitty-gritty of exactly how servers are starting and that sort of thing. Well, I suppose actually, yeah. Something like, does it still have cron, or do you have to use systemd timers?
It's a good question. I'm not sure. I imagine they will keep some things around like cron for a while at least, because I think they can coexist side by side. Obviously, it's simpler to use systemd timers. It's all more integrated. But yeah.
Ben and I are off to see the new Debian project lead this week. So if anybody's got any questions they want us to ask him, leave us a comment and we'll try and do so. It's going to be interesting meeting him, you know, the pretty much the week after this major release. I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah. If only didn't take so long to get to Cambridge.
Yeah. We do insist on living out in the West Country, though.
I don't understand why everyone else doesn't live out in the West Country, though. Right, more Linux release news. Ubuntu has followed Debian by releasing another release, 15.04, which also comes with systemd. So it's been a good month for systemd, really.
Well, I guess the two go hand in hand, don't they? The decision that Debian made to go with systemd is why Ubuntu went with systemd. So,
yeah.
I mean, considering they've done really well, Canonical and Ubuntu, to, you know, switch from Upstart to systemd and make it all work. Isn't there still parts of Upstart working in there, or is it?
To be honest, I don't know. I haven't updated my Ubuntu systems. I'm still on 14.04. But there's quite a few new bits in Ubuntu as well as systemd. There's a lot more to Ubuntu Make, which there used to be known as Ubuntu Developer Tools, and it's their sort of one-stop shop for setting up a development environment for pretty much any system now. So you can pull in your Android development tools and all that sort of thing with just one.
I was really impressed with Ubuntu's development studio for the Ubuntu phone. I mean, it's all built around Qt Creator, but they'd gone to a lot of trouble to customize the interface and you know, insert all of the API reference and everything that you needed into a single place. So I could imagine they'd do a good job at that.
Yeah, it's certainly looking good. To a certain extent, I do wonder, you know, I mean, the main advantage is that you can just do one or two commands and have your full development environment set up. But do you change development environments frequently enough for that to be a problem?
No. No, but I mean, it's the convenience, yeah. I mean, some people kind of spin up development environments and they need them quite quickly, and it makes that easier. And I suppose it creates, if they've got lots of developers and maybe they're trying to encourage new developers, then everybody's got the same starting point. They've all got the same stuff installed easily. They know, you know, I suppose it's like installing a KDE meta package or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is also the first Ubuntu release to feature Ubuntu Mate.
Oh, yeah.
Or as an official spin. It's been available for a while, but now it's official, which means it's all built on the Canonical infrastructure and whatnot. So to all those who wish that they could go back to the pre-Unity Ubuntu,
yeah,
now can.
Do you think that's a bit of backtracking on Canonical's part? Because it did seem a couple of years ago when, they dropped all of peripheral Ubuntu spins, and there was huge debate about whether Kubuntu would still be official, and it seemed like Ubuntu was just going to be Ubuntu with at least Unity by default.
They didn't drop anything, did they? They just stopped employing people to create it.
Yeah,
they made it more community.
Yeah, whereas, you know, 10 years ago when they started, they were happy to kind of encourage diversity, and then They've gone for unification and, you know, putting all their efforts behind Mir and Unity and the phone and everything. And that kind of made sense. But now is this a little bit of, you know, a little bit more going back to what made the Ubuntu distribution desktop environment 10 years ago, 8 years ago, so successful? Perhaps.
Wow. And there's another new part of this Ubuntu release, and that's Ubuntu Core with Snappy, that was released in as a sort of beta version a few months ago. It's now been released as part of 15.04.
And haven't they said as well they want to move to Snappy for software packaging in the future, away from .debs?
I mean, it does make sense for some things.
We worried about, for the desktop, there must be some kind of performance impact.
So Snappy is some sort of package manager?
It's a bit like, we did an FAQ about it in Linux Voice, and it's basically Canonical's, it's come about from Canonical's phone environment and cloud stuff, where they basically create a complete minimal installation of Linux, and then in a kind of cheroot or in a sandbox environment, it allows you to install different versions of libraries side by side and applications side by side and roll forward and roll back through those versions. So it's a bit halfway between kind of what Docker does and also bridging the kind of desktop. It's what you need when you have a phone, because you don't want somebody to write an application that can then take over the entire system. So they need to be sandboxed in that way. And I guess they've seen those advantages for Ubuntu in general too, which is one of the reasons why containerization has been such a success.
And another goal is to make it easier to add third-party software, isn't it? At the moment, take Ubuntu, you want the third-party program, you either have to download some random debs and double-click them and hope they all work, or add a PPA, which is more hassle. A lot of people from other platforms are used to just going somewhere, going to a site and saying, click, oh, I have a program. I mean, obviously, there are security implications in such a system as well, but, yeah, you know, there's a balance.
Sounds like quite a major release, full of kind of quite a lot for Ubuntu in this, you know, lots of important things, infrastructure stuff.
Yeah, I mean, is there any news about when Mir is supposed to be coming, though?
About a year ago, I think, Mike. Well, the point, as far as I'm aware, there hasn't been a change since Mark Shuttleworth said they won't switch until the majority of users want to, whatever that means. So, moving on with our next item of news. 78% of companies responded to a survey by Black Duck Software saying that they run part or all of their infrastructure on free and open source software. This is up from 42% in 2010. So in other words, 8 out of 10 companies are running FOSS at the core of their business, not just sort of little peripheral bits around the edge, but actually their infrastructure, the heart of their company.
I guess it's to be expected in a way, isn't it? If you've got a mail server, you've got a web server, you've got a router, somewhere in the pipeline is going to be some sort of Linux, BSD, open source. Trying to run absolutely everything on proprietary software is probably really difficult now.
Which companies are these? Is this in the UK or the US or Tajikistan or where?
I was actually a little bit cagey when I read through their report as to which companies they were. All they said were they ones responded to their survey.
Right.
The Linux so companies they emailed.
Yeah, so there's certainly a sort of self-selecting bias to
okay.
it.
Okay. So we'll treat this with all the validity it deserves then.
Yeah. Less than 3% of companies said they didn't use any open source software. And I suspect 3% of companies didn't realise they were using some open source software.
Well, that's what I would have been tempted to say about the 2010 results, is that the news that the company was using open source software just hadn't made it to the IT managers who'd been asking the question.
Well, I mean, there's still a lot of companies doing things like running Windows LDAP servers and Active Directory and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, Microsoft's done very well locking people into Active Directory.
Yeah, I'm sure there's still some people running IIS web servers who just bought a license 10 years ago. so it's looking like FOSS is on the rise, continues to be on the rise in industry.
It brings us back to the point of Shellshock and Heartbleed, though, doesn't it? How many of these companies are actually contributing something back to free software and open source? Probably not many, I'd wager.
That was actually a question on the survey.
Oh.
And I got halfway through writing down the answer, and then I didn't. And if I can read through my scribbles, I think it says 64% claim to be supporting...
contributing back.
Yeah.
64%?
Yeah.
That's not bad. That's more than I'd expect.
Yeah, me too.
It's also quite possible that the people responding don't really understand what that means, or some developer once submitted a patch.
Yeah,
2 years ago.
Exactly. Yeah, it reminds me of when Apple was claiming to be a great open source supporter by giving their modifications to what was it called, KHTML, back to KDE. They just threw a 40 gigabyte tarball at them and here you go, guys. Yeah,
2 years later.
Yeah, 2 years later, and it's that's not how you contribute back, Apple.
Yeah.
Yeah. More on our fortnightly Microsoft news.
Ooh, my favourite section.
We should give this some special jingle.
Yeah, we should. Like the Windows, Brian Eno's start sound.
Could see if Microsoft want to sponsor it.
I think, hey, I know what you're going to say, and Microsoft probably would. We could probably get lots of money.
Where do you want to go today?
Yeah. Microsoft have teamed up with Cyanogen Inc. to bundle Microsoft services into Cyanogen OS. So by services, I mean Bing searches, Maps, that sort of thing, Skype, OneDrive, OneNote, Outlook, and Microsoft Office. And it's important to realise that Cyanogen OS is different to Cyanogen Mod. Cyanogen OS is a sort of commercial thing that you can pay Cyanogen Inc. to create an image for your device that you want to sell. Cyanogen Mod is the modified open source version.
Yeah.
Yeah, of Android. So this doesn't have any impact on Cyanogen Mod, although it may mean that in the future that you have the option to install them, but it certainly shouldn't be bundled by default.
So this Cyanogen Inc. seems like quite a big sort of business now. I just thought Cyanogen Mod was like two bedroom hackers messing around.
They've had I don't want to exaggerate, and I don't know the numbers, but they've had many millions of dollars in angel investment for their new endeavor. And this is, I think, got people worried.
I believe it was $7 million.
$7 million. So they are, and it took them about 24 hours to clarify what this actually meant when it first was news that they were going to bundle Microsoft services. And it took them a while to say, this isn't going to affect the source tree of Cyanogen Mod. That will always remain free and open source and unafflicted by whatever we decide to do with the commercial side.
Yeah, because the uproar on the internet at the time,
but it's early days. Destroyed.
I think that could be a bit cynical, a bit of it's no such thing as bad publicity.
I think... Well, the Cyanogen Inc. They're onto something, you know. They've got this OS that they can basically do what they want. I mean, Google doesn't have control over it. It's the elephant in the room for their success, and what open source is all about. But could it be that this is the moment where Cyanogen Mod then has to be forked to something else, or somebody else to carry on the flame of what. Is it open source and an open mobile phone operating system?
The thing about this for me is, would you buy a Cyanogen OS phone?
I would buy I would buy a phone with Cyanogen Mod on it.
I would.
If it was the open source version.
but I'm not sure I would want a CyanogenMod OS phone. I don't know who it's marketed to.
Yeah, and they can keep those bits closed. They don't actually have to say.
Yeah, but who's their customer? Who's their target customer? Because you've got the people who want to get away from Google services and they can use CyanogenMod. The Microsoft services aren't as good as the Google services. Bing isn't as good as Google Maps, as Google Search and Maps and that sort of thing. And what's the value proposition?
I guess you get to if Microsoft created an Android app store,
but it's never going to be as good as Google Play Store.
No, but it may not stop them trying or seeing what the potential is. And it's in a way, they're far more advanced than Ubuntu phone with, trying to create a whole brand new operating system.
True, but that actually has a reason to buy it. It's something new. It's something different. Mm. This isn't. This is just Android, but with worse services.
Yeah.
CyanogenMod, at least, is open source Android. It's Android that doesn't spy on you, et cetera, et cetera.
Amazon's been able to do it.
Does anyone use a Fire phone?
No.
I mean...
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, Microsoft can afford to just keep all of its options open. And I guess that's what it's doing.
It's true. I mean, it does seem a little bit of a weird word that we're talking about. Microsoft partnering up with a Linux vendor to create services on top of a Linux-based phone. I think we should,
yeah.
But I just don't see this as being a good move for Cyanogen Inc. But what do I know? final item in our news: Fortnite KDE 5.3 has been released. This comes with improved power management and Bluetooth capabilities.
I guess that falls to me.
As our resident KDE correspondent.
I haven't upgraded to 5.3, but I think it's like 5.294 or something, the packages that I've had installed on my KDE Arch. There are some genuinely noticeable improvements. For example, there isn't a decent GUI to Intel's PowerTop. PowerTop is its like command line tool for showing you which processors are using so much power. And so the KDE Info Center now has a panel that shows you the power drain that tasks are doing. So things like Plasma itself or Firefox, how much power it's drawing from your laptop's battery.
Is that actually accurate? I've always assumed that PowerTop was wildly inaccurate.
I don't know. I'd assumed as it was Intel that put the hooks in its CPU and Intel that had written the code for PowerTop. I just assumed that. At least, I don't know, in some circumstances it's got to be accurate. I don't know. I mean, it's really detailed. I'm not so sure about the options it allows you to change and whether that makes any good. I don't know whether it's Arch or whether it's KDE, but the power drain of my laptop has got considerably worse over the last couple of months. There are other things. There's a new Bluetooth module. So previously you had to use the old KDE4 module. So now that's been updated. And I think I remember reading that they've made huge inroads into making KDE run on Wayland by forking the GUI to X-Wayland in preparation for a time when there's a proper Wayland backend, which is good. There's still no file manager, which I think is crazy. So if you need Dolphin, you have to install the old KDE 4 Dolphin.
Really?
Yeah.
What is this?
It's on GitHub, so you can build it yourself, but it's just too far off being usable. And I think there are a few other options. It's another good solid KDE upgrade and a great step in the right direction. I'm really loving KDE at the moment. I think it looks really beautiful. There's widget stuff, like you can click and move widgets without unlocking them. And I really like, even though there's a bug in it, the new CPU usage widget that sits in your panel at the bottom of the window or wherever you put it, is there's a circular option. So it's like this really neatly rendered disk that fills up like a rev counter on a car, which looks really beautiful. But In one of the updates, it broke, so that if you have the CPU meter on its own, you only see the letters CPU and not the meter itself. But if you put the memory meter alongside it, they both work.
How many CPU cycles does the CPU meter actually use to display all this?
I just don't trust computers not doing stuff in the background. So I've always had one on my screen. I've still got one even looking at it now.
Yeah, I put one on recently in XFCE because Firefox, for no reason, just decides to max up CPU when you close it. Firefox got really, really bad recently, just all sorts of bugs because, you know, they're not bothered about making a browser anymore. They went up to all sorts of other nonsense. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's nice to have that around to know if something's burning through my battery.
So the only things missing are the Dolphin and I'd say the telepathy framework, which I think has been ported, but not the apps itself, which is the instant messaging and communications protocol used in KDE. That, I haven't seen any apps using that, but there's a touchpad panel for configuring your touchpad as well, which was badly missed. I'd been configuring everything through the SYN client command line tool for my touchpad, but now you can do it through a GUI, which is good. There are more changes than that, but they're the main ones I've noticed. Go KDE.
Go KDE. One day you'll have a file manager. Yeah.
One day we'll be back at 3.5.
And that's all the news this fortnight.
Thanks for the epic news, Ben.
Epic news.
It's now time for Finds of the Fortnight. I'll start off with the IRC channel, because just before we started recording, I asked the channel if they had any finds, and there were a few. Tallwag says, Y Pi on Kickstarter. I took a quick look at this, and it's like this tiny, tiny controller board with Wi-Fi enabled that you can program through Wi-Fi with Python. It's tiny. I'm holding my hand. It's like an inch and a half or something like that. And it's like 25 or 30 euro. It's like an Arduino-alike thing for programming over Wi-Fi so you don't connect it to stuff. And then you could make it the hub of your, I'm loath to say it, but Internet of Things thing. It looks like a pretty cool project. It's cheap and it's open source. It's open hardware. I really should back it, actually. It uses MicroPython. Hamster Jam says a Kubuntu 15.04. I've not tried it yet, but Kubuntu is usually a very good version of KDE running on Ubuntu. Torwag also says they were discussing the Hemming Write, which I think was another crowdfunded project, but it's quite expensive. It's like $200 or $300, and it's a typewriter with an e-ink display. So you can pretend you're Ernest Hemingway and sit down by the sea and write your novel with your hipster coffee.
Didn't Hemingway write standing up?
Did he? I don't know.
I think so.
On the back of a rhino.
Shooting another rhino.
And so Torwag's really on form. I said, a more related but still not really Linux-based find is IPython notebooks are awesome to teach and learn about coding, performing literate programming and reproducible research. You can even give presentations, slideshows, in which you can execute and change code during the presentation. If you finally have time, have a quick look at github.com/DamianVillaRise. I don't really know what that is. IPython notebooks.
Yeah, IPython is really cool in that it's sort of this interactive programming environment where, you know, you type commands and they execute, etc. But it's got this stuff like you can export to HTML. So you can see the full session as it happens.
Ah, right, okay.
Yeah. And if you've got an IPython backend running, you can connect to it via the HTML interface and run commands in it and get the...
Oh, cool.
Yeah, get the output in the HTML presentation.
Yeah, yeah.
Or web page.
Okay, that does sound neat. And then finally from IRC, Hamster Jam says network monitoring tools UDP Mon has just had a new release. I'll put the URL in the notes. He said there's a video there on the site that shows you more. I like the idea of UDP monitoring tools, so I'll have to have a look at that. They're the finds from IRC. Does anyone else want to have a go? I can go. There's no one. I haven't really got a major find, except that in our house where I live, when we bought it, it had an alarm system, a passive infrared alarm system. And all the wires from all of the passive infrared sensors in all the rooms come into a central place in the attic. And I'd really like to be able to... So I'm asking for advice. Can I connect something like a Raspberry Pi GPIO to those sensors? I don't know anything about it, whether they send encrypted data or they send simple pulses, whether I could use, you know, GPIO stuff. Like we've run a tutorial on PIR with GPIOs. And I don't know. So if anybody knows how I can hack into my own alarm system so that I can write a simple program to tell me when sensors have been triggered, I'd be really interested. As part of my research, there is, this is my discovery, Private iPi, which is exactly this kind of project
awesome.
For monitoring sensors in your home. And if you don't have a setup already configured, then you can buy your own sensors, put them in, there are wireless ones, put them in different rooms, different magnets on doors and stuff like this. Connect it all to your Raspberry Pi, run this software, and you've got this awesome little mobile phone app that will tell you temperature, where the sensors have been triggered, where they've been triggered. You can create zones. I'm not interested in it from a security perspective at all. You know, I live in a safe place, but I am, from a geek perspective, I am interested in which rooms are being used and when.
The first thing I'd want to know is how many wires come off each PIR?
Yeah, I've looked at, I can't tell unless I open up the alarm box. I've looked at similar sensors as the ones I've got in the house, and there's like four. So I think there's two for power and there's two for the alarm system.
Because a standard hobbyist PIR sense has three wires, right. A positive, a negative, and a signal, and the signal will either go high or low.
So the signal is pretty basic.
It's incredibly basic. That's what you'll get if you buy one from a hobbyist electronics shop. And then you can plug those straight into GPIOs, obviously with a bit of protection with resistors,
but
you don't need any additional logic. I've no idea about an alarm one. They may well have anti-tamper stuff built in.
I think there is an anti-tamper lead, but I mean, if I disconnect that or disable it from the alarm system itself, I mean, the PIR sensors look identical to the really basic stuff you get from a hobbyist shop. I mean, they don't look, it's just a home installation. It's not like, you know, Fort Knox.
You have to get your oscilloscope on the wire.
Yeah, well, I was a little bit afraid of opening it up in case the alarm actually went off. But I'm just going to have to be brave, I think, and take... I can see through a couple of holes that all of the wires come into like a really basic breadboard connector that then is attached to the main PCB. So I was just thinking, you know, I could take some of the wires off the sensors or maybe connect it at the same time. I'd love to know if someone's done it.
Could you combine it with Ben's face tracking tutorial thing in a previous issue and shoot criminals in the face when they come in?
Yeah, yeah, that's what I'm going to do. So that's my find. There's the Raspberry Pi one, but I'd love to have some advice if anybody else has done something similar because, you know, an alarm system's really boring. It would be really cool to have something logging where people are.
Someone else should go before me because someone's mowing the lawn outside, as you might be able to hear.
I was wondering what that was. Shall I go next?
Yeah.
I've got a few finds this fortnight, although people who follow me on Twitter will know some of them already. One thing I've discovered, actually noticed this in a comment on a Reddit thread, that if you're in a terminal and you type your command, if you press Alt, then the full stop, or period if you're American, key, you will cycle through the previous arguments to commands you've done. Mm. So if you write, I don't know, ls blah 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 to make sure something the check the permissions or something, and then you want to remove it, you could do rm alt dot and it will pop up.
That's excellent.
That's a brilliant discovery. That's the first really good one we've ever had.
Well, just wait till you hear my next one. Actually, my next one's not as good, really. I've done this all wrong. I should have saved that one for last. From now on, it's just going to be disappointing. We run some analytics software on linuxvoice.com just to sort of see what people are looking at and to try and make sure we've got interesting content, really. But one of the things it does is it grabs the the user agent, which is what your browser sends to us to tell us what you're running. And we can sort of sort this to see what devices people are using to make sure we're optimizing the right way. But I've discovered that somebody's browsed linuxvoice.com from a camera. Someone's browsed it from a car.
Wow.
A car.
Six different people have browsed it from a feature phone.
Wow. I don't wonder what our site looks like on a feature phone.
I just got this picture of this like Nokia 5510 trying to browse it.
Wow. Do you see any interesting operating systems there, Ben, like Amigas or anything? Or?
Not that I recall. I can look at it quickly now. No, it would take too long, actually. But
a car, somebody browsing in their car, that's dangerous.
Yeah, so you know, like the fancy cars have the touchscreen displays for
hey, I wonder if that's for the podcast. I wonder if they've tuned into the podcast through their car.
It could be.
If you are that person, listener, then please leave a comment and stay safe on the road. Yeah.
Or it could just be someone changing their user agent to mess with us as well.
Yeah, yeah. There'll be a lot more random user agents next time.
Oh, yeah. Look what we've started. International Space Station.
Yeah.
That would just come up as Debian.
Yeah.
Another thing I noticed, that there's been a bit of a change in some of the search traffic coming to us recently. In February, for example, there's about a 7 or 8 times rise in the number of people coming to us from Yahoo search.
Hmm.
And I think that corresponds to when Firefox changed in Europe.
Of course, yeah.
So, admittedly, this is an increase from about 5 people to about 40 people. But
yeah,
it's certainly had an impact. And also, more recently, actually, in March, there was a 4 times rise in people using DuckDuckGo to come to us. And again, it's similar. It's tiny numbers. There hasn't been a corresponding increase from Bing at all. In fact, Bing have been slowly losing their share of search to us, and Google have been saying roughly the same. And Baidu and Yandex haven't changed either. But just specifically, DuckDuckGo and Yahoo have both had a very large, at least in terms of proportion, increase recently.
Has Google gone down?
Google, as a proportion, it's been staying the same. There's been a slight drop recently. But Mobilegeddon doesn't seem to have affected us too much recently. But I think that's because we get a very small proportion of our search from mobile. And one last thing I discovered just this morning, actually. It's a logic puzzle. It's billed as the hardest logic puzzle in the world, according to XKCD. And I did manage to work it out, so it is solvable. And I'll just...
Hang on, I think I know this. You bring the goat back with you on the boat.
No.
That's right, isn't it?
James Mason.
The reason I've come across a lot of logic puzzles, and most of them are fairly straightforward. I like this one because it's actually, the solution to it is both difficult and genuinely logical. You've got to think about it pretty hard to work it out. And the puzzle is this. A group of people with assorted eye colour live on an island. They are all perfect logicians. If a conclusion can be logically derived, they will do it instantly. No one knows the colour of their eyes. Every night at midnight, a ferry stops on the island, and any islanders who have figured out the colour of their own eyes can leave the island, but the rest have to stay. Everyone can see everyone else at all times and keep a count of the number of people they see with each eye colour, except themselves. But they can't communicate, and everyone on the island knows these rules. On the island, there are 100 blue-eyed people and 100 brown-eyed people, and a guru who has green eyes. So any one person with blue eyes can see 100 people with brown eyes and 99 people with blue eyes and one with green, but they don't know that there are equal numbers of blue and brown eyes. So as far as they're concerned, there could be 101 brown-eyed people and 99 blue-eyed people. Or they might have orange eyes or something like that. And the guru is only allowed to speak once, and she stands up and says, "I can see someone who has blue eyes." And the question is, who leaves the island and on what night? And it's not a trick question. It's a genuine logic question. So there's nothing like, oh, there was a mirror on the ship, or they don't see their reflection in it. They're not, the guru wasn't looking at anyone in particular when she said that. And somebody does leave the island. The answer isn't no one leaves. I won't wait for you to get there.
Thanks, Ben.
Without meaning to be insulting, it would be quite a lot of dead air.
More than normal.
I've got deja vu. Have we done this before? Yeah.
Okay, that's good. That sounds interesting. I'd like to think about it. Are you going to reveal the answer now?
No.
Okay. Does XKCD explain the logic behind it?
If you know the answer, the logic's obvious. Okay. But yeah.
Okay. Ace finds. Thanks. Anyone else?
Yeah, I've got a find. It's the digital DIY project. And this is viewable on the interwebs at diy.eu, I think. Yes, there it is. Diy.eu. The .eu domain may give away that it's a European project by our European overlords in Europe, and so it's written in that sort of lingua franca of Euro English, that
Esperanto.
You know when you go to foreign and there are foreigners speaking English, they can understand each other, but you can often, or rather I find, I'm like, what? Hey, sorry, what? Even though I've been speaking English for, you know, 30 odd years, I can't understand what people are talking about. Anyway, so it's all about the digital do-it-yourself. It's about the frontiers between physical Internet of Things, code, and legal issues that surround this new framework. So one of the chaps involved is our very own Marco Fioretti. It's various universities around Europe. What's this? University of Westminster, one in Turkey, one in Italy. And Marco says that the... Yes. So one example that Marco gives is if you have a so rather than having one factory churning out, you know, plastic replacement parts in Guangdong and then posting them all around the world, it's the scenario may come about where you have a 3D print shop in every town. You download a schema from somewhere and then take it to the local print shop, and then they build it. And then, you know, then you go and collect it, or they post it to you locally. And this seems like quite a feasible way of making, you know, global production, very short production runs, quite feasible. With, you know, as 3D printers, you know, it seems like a bit of a waste to have a 3D printer in every home, which is sitting idle most of the time. But if there's one for every village or town or decent sized, whatever appropriately sized conurbation there is. So you could have a, you know, if you buy a chair from one of these companies, you know, and you break your back when your chair breaks, is it the 3D printing shop in your town that's liable? Is it the design uploaded to a Russian server by a Chinese company, or is it the plastic which you ordered from Malaysia? The idea of you know, the global village and everybody would be able to contribute to things, and it will spread innovation and make things cheaper, but you cross all sorts of legal boundaries and legal jurisdictions when you bring these things together. And that's just one of the questions that Marco and this group is wanting to answer. It looks, I mean, I think it looks really interesting, because why? What's that snort for?
No, it does. It does sound interesting.
I think there's a big question. You know, there's some big questions behind this. So that's, you know, I urge you to have a look at this, and you know, maybe you'll get more out of it than I will. But there's, it's, you know, and then also there is a little bit of it that says, you know, how can we get a research grant out of the EU? But yeah, but hey, good luck to them, you know.
That leaves you, Mike.
That's my find. There we go.
Thanks, Andrew.
Oh, my find was graciously donated to me by a listener, as in recent tradition, this time from Gavin Jamie, who's an NHS doctor. He says, I enjoy the podcast very much in the magazine and thought I would chip in with a find. Although I use a Windows machine at work, unavoidable due to very specialist software that GP practices run, I have a server for mail and other things. My favourite very small utility is WDay, which I've not seen covered before. My Windows machine takes ages to boot up in the morning, so I've set it up to boot on network from the email server. The obvious candidate to do this was a cron job, but what about bank holidays, Easter, Christmas, etc.? Well, WDay is an excellent utility to save any given day is a work day. It works around the world with files from many countries. Interestingly, it does not use an online source or static file of holidays from many things. Instead, calculates bank holidays itself. With Easter, this involves calculation of the phases of the moon. It's complicated, but also rather cool. My cron job just runs WDay and then sends the magic packet if it returns a value indicating that today is a day I should go to work.
Wow. That does sound spectacular, and huge props to the programmer who, you know, obviously had a few weeks spare.
The problem with that is not all holidays can be calculated exactly. Some are based on actual sightings. For example, when I lived in Tanzania, the end of Ramadan was when a particular imam first saw the moon. And sometimes you can say exactly what day it will be on. Sometimes you can say it'll be either be on this day or that day. This seems relatively unusual. I've spoken to people who lived in other Islamic countries and they're like, don't be stupid. We always know what day Ramadan ends. Yeah. But for some reason in Tanzania, they didn't.
You could submit
and
a patch.
You just wake up. Yeah, and you just, it'd just sort of be the thing. You go to work, oh no, it ended a day early. They saw the moon. It's like, oh, it's a bank holiday now. Man.
That's not how Ramadan works.
Well, great. Maybe you could sue the WDay authors then if you miss a day of work because it's miscalculated. But yeah, hey, pretty cool.
Really,
thanks, Gavin.
Yeah, yeah. Thanks, everyone. That was excellent.
And after 40-odd minutes, that brings us to our halfway reminder. Still to come. Still to come, there may or may not be some neurons to vocalise or brains to speak. But there will definitely be our voice of the masses.
Awesome. Well, we have one neuron and it's fairly quick, so I'll get stuck right in. This is from good old Who. He says, during the discussion about elementary OS, Ben remarked that people don't want to pay for desktop Linux. Well, I've actually been thinking about this and I've realised that it's something I'd actually consider if it included expert support. One of the reasons I've distro hopped so much is I've encountered a serious issue with distro X and the community has been unable to help me to fix it. If I could buy an otherwise free distro that included a year or even 6 months of priority support directly from the people that maintain the distro, I think that money would be well spent and would certainly help me to stick with one install for more than a few weeks. Thanks, Who. That's interesting. You used to be able to buy box sets of distros with technical support built provided with it. You know, you'd spend £50 or whatever. You can't get that anymore from Red Hat. And I see that with the closest...
Was there actually any support with those box sets?
Yeah, I'm sure you could get, like, email, or they might have even had a phone number, maybe with Mandriva or Mandrake's Power Pack. At least email support. The closest I've seen is you can get Ubuntu Advantage for its desktop, but you have to buy it in a pack of five, and that's £385 for a year. If they sold those, you know, individually, that'd be £77 a year, which for some people, you know, new to Linux, could be worth paying for a year of phone support. But you, like I say, you have to buy them in packs of five. The Ubuntu website actually says less than five users, just get free support at askubuntu.com. But I can understand a lot of people want, you know, an immediate answer from an email or on the end of a phone. So.
I'm always very reluctant to ask for help, you know, and there's got to be something for antisocial people like me.
I think the problem with the paid support for Linux is that, in general, support like that works because it averages out to being reasonably cheap. You can, you know, say Windows is 50 quid and then you get support. But most people don't use it, so therefore the few people that do use it, they can afford to support. But if you had it with Linux, everyone who didn't need it wouldn't bother paying. They'll just have the free version. Everyone who did need it would
pay really for good
it
point.
And expect it. But it actually costs quite a lot to support. You know, say you pay £50 a year, that's only a couple of hours of support time when you factor in you know, the costs of the offices and everything else. So it actually doesn't become a very good business. At least that's why I think it doesn't work.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes they limit these things to a number of incidents, don't they, to stop you hogging the phone lines all year. They say, you know, you can have 3 phone instances and 10 email instances. So, yeah, that might work. I think, yeah, clearly there isn't such a big market for it. There used to be more of this in the early 2000s. I guess when fewer people were on the net as well, or fewer people had such good connections, when it was normal to actually buy a big box set with like 5 DVDs in.
I'm inventing systems now, but maybe we could kind of crowdsource the solution. So, you know, we get so many thousand people who want to contribute to something like this in terms of offering their support, and then you create a phone number that distributes the call to somebody, and then everybody who answers successfully a support question gets some share of whatever the subscription money people are paying. But it's farmed out, so you can say that it's a pound or it's a pint of beer, you know, but I mean it helps everybody involved.
Yeah,
I'd
but this is
do that.
This is the Linux community. Imagine what would happen. Somebody would phone up and say, I've got a problem with Debian. The guy on the end would be an Arch user and be like, no, you need to install Arch. And then someone else would be like, no, you need to remove systemd. And you'd end up following
how
a
How do I remove systemd?
Yeah.
You can't.
Oh, it would just be, note down your bank details. This is obviously the problem.
Yeah.
Drop them in an email. And,
just guys
email
so
me.
Cynical.
id.rsa.private or whatever.
I just want to spread the love, that's all. And you start stealing people's bank details.
That's it. That's an elf.
How's the snooker going, Mike?
I can't watch the Ronnie match because Eurosport is only showing the Murphy McGill match. And I've only got one channel, and I can't watch BBC on my computer because we're recording a podcast. So the sooner we're done, the quicker I can switch to watching one.
In that case, let's move on as swiftly as possible to Voice of the Masses. So you've already heard that the latest version of Debian Jesse, has been released, and it took about 2 years. So we want to know, we want you to tell us, is the Debian release cycle too long? Now, a bit of context, I suppose. You've got rolling releases, such as Arch and OpenSUSE to Tumbleweed, which, you know, they don't really have a release cycle. They're constantly releasing the newest stuff, always rolling out new packages for users. All you need to do is read the wiki, which is a very simple task, and you can just update your distro and everything's fine. Then we have the distros such as Ubuntu. Now, Ubuntu has a very predictable every 6 month, like clockwork, release cycle, which means that you know when, if you're only a week away from installing the next Ubuntu being released, there's no point in you wasting, you know, an afternoon installing Ubuntu. You may as well just hold off for a bit. It means that you always know where you stand, where you are with it. Now, with Debian, it takes the opposite approach. So they don't really have a set release schedule. They just release when it's ready, and that gives you stability and the safety that you know that nothing's been rushed into the release, and that nothing's going to break your system. Everything's going to be tickety boo and hunky dory, and that makes it excellent for servers. So, with that out of the way, no one thinks the Debian release cycle is too long. In fact, we've even been told off for even asking the question. Heisenberg says,
every time, listen, pay attention.
Do you know who I am?
We'd better tread very, very carefully. Every time Debian does an official stable release, people start asking this. Linux Voice loses credibility by joining the chorus. If you want true stability, Debian stable is where it's at, because it is truly stable. Unlike some other distros purporting to be stable, anyone can run fairly close to bleeding edge by running Debian in unstable. Want something in between? Debian testing is there for you. Stop spreading nonsense, says Heisenberg.
Yep, don't ask questions in the Linux world, ever.
That's right. It's not about choice. Or
opinions. No.
Or sharing information or anything.
Don't share stuff. Information.
Yeah. And everybody else says, well, apart from Heisenberg, everyone says, you know, Harry Nowell says, no, the release cycle is fine as it is. I run Debian on my server and laptop. The server runs stable with a few packages from testing, and the laptop runs unstable. Tony just says no. Hugh actually is a lone voice in the wilderness who says, yes, it is. Yes, it is too long. For all of Debian's famed stability, if you actually try using it for any length of time, you can and will encounter bugs, with the added problem that unless they're related to security, you'll have to wait a couple of years for the next update.
Ah. Yeah, this is an interesting point. Yeah, Debian is stable and it doesn't change much, but after 2 years, you will have a lot of old software where the bugs have been fixed in more recent releases. Debian will fix major data loss budgets and bugs and security problems, but it doesn't automatically mean that everything in the distro is more reliable than a newer distro.
It also means upgrades are a much bigger deal. You're shifting, you know, if you're running the previous version of Debian, you just upgrade. You're changing to 2 years newer software and, you know, Apache, et cetera, rather than just doing minor upgrades one at a time where fewer things break.
But isn't Debian more likely to be used by people with the technical nous to fix things when they've broken? I mean, it's not aimed at the apocryphal your mum, who we always used to use as an example of, or someone's grandma. It's not.
My mum uses Mint.
It's not aimed at your mum. It's aimed at someone's server administrator.
Is it?
I don't know. I've never really known this.
Because Debian seems a little bit different from most distros, and it kind of feels to me that Debian unstable and testing are aimed at desktop users, and Debian stable are aimed at server users. But I don't think that's anything official. I think that's just the way I've assumed it kind of works. And I think, broadly speaking, that is how it works.
I've met quite a few people over the years who always seem to have defaulted to Debian for, like, research and development or prototyping or stuff where they're working in teams on a longer project. And they just obviously use Debian. And then if ever they need to make something live, they'll switch to some other distribution at the end. But for just a working environment and for everyone working from the same packages, that's what they tend to do. And they don't need cutting edge stuff. They just need a Linux that works. I'm with everybody else. Debian scratches its own itch and they've chosen 2 years or 3 years for a certain reason. And if there was enough demand for a shorter release cycle, I mean, Ubuntu is almost it, but then it would happen.
Well, yeah. Michael Burke says a release cycle depends on what's being offered. Fedora offers cutting edge software, so there's an element of instability being offered by the distro. Debian, though, offers stability for both the server and desktop. I'm a desktop and server user. I spend more time on the desktop, though, and it has never once let me down. Fedora did several times. Espada V8 says Debian is focused on longer-term support. Even non-LTS releases last for 2+ years. I imagine that people that use Debian do so because of this, and switching to a quicker schedule would probably lose these people. Everyone's in accord. Hooray!
Up until this release, Debian has had one of the longest release schedules, but still not that much support compared to. I mean, Red Hat. It's Red Hat at 10 years.
Yeah.
Support, yeah.
Yeah, you're right.
Ubuntu's
that's
at 5.
That's a good point, considering the gestation period, if that's what it is, for the packages.
Yeah. So if you're actually looking at support over a long period, Is it the best option? I don't know.
No, I don't know. It's not what I'd choose for a server particularly. I'm not that, I know some people do, but I choose it as a more stable. It's on a few old devices that I've got that I still run. I don't even know what version of Debian they're running. You know, it doesn't matter, but it's familiar, and I know how to install stuff and remove stuff.
I wonder if anybody's ever put Arch on the server with Pac-Man SYU in a nightly cron job. I wonder how long that would last for.
Sorry, was I not supposed to do that on I seriously considered putting apt-get update on a cron job when they were just bash vulnerabilities seemed to be coming out every 6 hours.
Right, so that's it then. We're in agreement, everybody's in accord. Apart from Heisenberg, we don't want to ruffle Heisenberg's feathers. Well done, Debian team. Keep it going. And so that's the end of episode 7.
So many great moments.
Let's let Mike get back to the snooker, and we'll get back to working on issue 16.
Awesome. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.